Hello, I'm Chris English, welcoming you once more to another edition of At Home This Morning, a magazine programme of interviews about matters of interest for both our older listeners and those not so old, in and around the city of Brighton and Hove and further afield. In this edition of the programme, we'll be hearing from yachtswoman Tracy Edwards, MBE, who, with an all-woman crew, took on and very nearly beat the boys at their own game in the 1989-1990 Whitbread Round the World race. And after finding her beloved yacht Maiden in a derelict condition in the Seychelles, Tracy's about to do it all again some 28 years later and is looking for women of any age to join her. And who knows, one of those ladies could be you or someone you know. Now, many of our older listeners will remember seeing both trolleybuses and trams speeding up and down the many hills of our city. And so when I heard that a small group of enthusiasts had not only found an original Brighton tram, but were hard at work restoring it, I had to find out more. And as a result, we'll be hearing all about the Tram 53 project from Society President Guy Hall later in the programme. I'll also be talking to Admiral Nurse Penny Dodds from the charity Dementia UK to try and unravel some of the mysteries and taboos that arise from that illness, just as soon as someone utters that dreaded word, dementia. But we get underway with a look at the truly fascinating Maiden project that aims to send off an all-female crew on a truly epic round-the-world trip on a comparatively small sailing yacht called Simply Maiden. And to put us in the picture, I recently met up with Tracy Edwards MBE, who skippered the yacht 28 years ago, and who now explains what the project is all about.
Well, the Maiden project, which is the Maiden Factor, basically came about because we heard that Maiden had been dumped in the Seychelles 6 years ago, actually, although I only heard about it 4 years ago. I was looking for a project to do, and I thought, oh, I've got to rescue her. I can't let my beautiful old boat just, you know, sort of sink.
And, of course, for those that aren't quite sure, Maiden was the yacht that you sailed around the world with an all-female crew.
Yep, so Maiden carried myself and my crew, first all-female crew to sail around the world when we raced in the 1989 Whitbread Round the World race. Unheard of at the time, obviously, to have a bunch of girls on the boat. Much more common now, thank goodness. But we did rather well. We won two legs and came second overall, which was the best result for a British boat since 1977, and that actually hasn't been beaten yet. So Maiden was a real, you know, she was an iconic piece of British maritime history. And I had to sell her after the race, and she had her various adventures, as I have had my various adventures over the past 28 years. But when I discovered that she was rotting away in the Seychelles, I knew I had to rescue her. You know, she was the 13th crew member, and she's very special to so many people, not just us. And, you know, I think she's an inspiration. So we were in the process of rescuing her, and my daughter said to me, "So, Mummy, what are you going to do with the boat when you get her home?" And I went, "Oh, that's a very good point. I haven't really thought about that." So she said, "Why don't you use her to raise money for girls' education? Because, you know, you work with all these girls' educational charities." And I just thought, this is fantastic. This is, can be her legacy. You know, it's really represents, you know, showing girls what they can do if they're given an opportunity, reaching their full potential, which is everything that we were lucky enough to be able to do with Maiden. So we raised the funds through crowdfunding to buy her, and we bought her in October 2016. Then an amazing thing happened. King Hussein Jordan was our sponsor for Maiden the first time round. He was pretty much the only male that believed that we could do it. They put his money where his mouth was. And then in November, I was contacted by his daughter, Her Royal Highness Princess Haya bint Al Hussein, who'd heard about the Maiden project and wanted to help. She said, "In honour of my father, I want to make Maiden happen again." So she's come in and very generously funded the rescue of Maiden, the restoration. And the next phase for us then is, after we've done the restoration, she'll be launched. And then we'll be doing a 3-year world tour. We'll be covering 30 stopovers in 18 countries. And that is all to do with raising awareness of and funding for girls' education.
So it's about girls, but it's also about women as well, isn't it?
Well, Maiden really is about empowering women and really, you know, this is about showing, well, everyone really, that, you know, so how you reach your true potential. And what we have found is that Maiden is an inspiration not just for my generation who remember Maiden the first time, but we've got people telling their children, their sons and their daughters, this is Maiden, this is what she did, this was unheard of. So we've got this amazing sort of generational thing going on where Maiden is becoming relevant, especially this year, 100 years since women got the vote in the UK. So it really is across the board. And of course, if you empower women and you educate girls, you improve society for everyone.
You said restoring the vote. I mean, it's not a simple task, is it?
It has been a lot more involved than we thought. She was in a much worse condition than we'd realised. I really think if we hadn't got her onto a ship when we did, she was close to sinking, and that would have been it. So she's an aluminium boat, which means that the aluminium reacts with oxygen in the water and you get electrolysis, which basically eats away at the hull. If you don't have anodes in the water, which are lead-based, and sort of they get eaten away instead. So we did a survey before we bought her. We knew we would always buy her, no matter what state she was in. And we got her back to the UK, sandblasted her off. And I remember we all just stood there looking at her going, oh my goodness. So we really have spent, the last 10 months, we have spent taking her apart, replacing, cutting out parts of her hull, welding new plates in. You know, we've completely rehauled all the underneath the keel, the bulb on the keel, the rudder. And now we've sort of moved up to, so the interior has also been taken apart. We have restructured and redesigned because of new coding, health and safety, which we have to do because we're going to be taking paying guests. So that's all been done. And literally last week, we just started putting her back together again, which is the exciting bit.
I was going to say, that must please you to see her coming back and looking less like a wreck and more like a nice shiny yacht that she was.
Well, it really got to the point where I said to the guys who are working in the yard, please don't send me any more pictures. I can't look at them. They're too sad. And then Howard, our project manager, who was also the project manager the first time round, talk about a glutton for punishment, he sent me a picture last week saying, I think you'll like this picture. And we have all the insulation in and the bulkheads as well, so she does now look like a boat again.
And presumably lots of modern electronics.
The electronics are the only thing that we're modernising. Everything, so we're restoring her to be as she was, because we think that she's a part of history, and that when people go sailing on her, they will want to sail on an 1890 Whitbread boat, not a modernisation of that. But we have given way to technology and development with the electronics on board. Obviously, the advances in technology in the past 30 years are off the scale. So the nav station will look very, very different. And obviously, it'll be safer and easier to use. And, you know, we need to move with the times in some areas, but the rest of the boat will be as it was.
You talk about we. Is that the original women's crew?
There's one of the original crew who works with me. She's actually on the charity side, so she runs the Maiden Factor Foundation. After Maiden, she worked for social services with vulnerable children for 25 years. So she's a perfect shoo-in for that. And we've been friends since we were 10 years old, so we also go way back. All of the original crew will be coming to the UK for the premiere of the documentary Maiden, which will be shown in June. So that will be the first time we've been together for 27 years, which will be.
So that's going to be quite some celebration, I guess. But you're in touch with them all?
We've always been in touch, and we've had various reunions, but we've never been, because we're spread all over the world, we've never been able to get all 12 of us back in the same place at the same time. So it's the first time it's going to happen.
So there might be a bit of fizz in there.
There may be a couple of glasses of champagne. I don't know. but no, I'm really looking forward to that. My new team, some of my new team, there's Joe Gooding from the original Maiden, Howard Gibbons, who was our project manager, is back. He was talking about retiring, but I said, no, you're not going to be doing that. So he's running the restoration. And then we've got, there's a team of 12 of us, and we work in various places. There's four of us here in the office in London, then there's three people down in Hamble in the boatyard. Our head of security is in Edinburgh. But of course, you can work like this now, so we're sort of spread all over the place. And we'll really only properly come together in September when we launch the boat properly, and then she goes off on her world tour.
Before the world tour, is there an opportunity for people to sail on her and see her in the UK?
Yeah, absolutely. So she'll be in the water round about the beginning of July, and then she'll be on the Solent sailing and doing lots and bits and pieces at Carol's Week, July and August. There's an area on our website that you can go onto if you want to see if you can buy a day sail. There's also crew applications going on. We're being deluged at the moment by some quite extraordinary young female sailors who would all like the chance to sail on Maiden. And then she will be in London in September. She'll be at St Catherine's Dock. So if you look at the website, www.themaidenfactor.org, we'll be updating events as we go along, and anyone can come and see her.
You talked then about day sales, so people can book a day sale.
Yeah, well, what we're doing, one of the ways we're raising funds for our foundation for girls' education is to use Maiden to raise those funds. So that will be, people will be able to buy places on Maiden to sail around the world. There'll be different legs. They'll be able to buy a day sail on the boat. And all that money goes to our foundation.
Now, you talked earlier about people, young people. Are there any age limits?
No.
Apart from us?
No. No. Well, you're never too old to start sailing, that's for sure. We on the legs, we can't take under 18-year-olds because of various the wonderful new world of health and safety, which I'm getting my head around because that didn't exist 30 years ago. So anywhere between 18, and there is no upper age limit. You also don't have to have really any or that much sailing experience, because there'll be a week sailing course which will be compulsory before you're allowed to come onto the boat.
And are you going?
I will be doing some of it. Our first leg is down to Jordan, which is a leg I would have liked to do, because even though we're so closely linked to Jordan, the boat's never been there. So this is very exciting. Everyone can't wait for her to get to Aqaba. But I have a new skipper. Which is quite a strange feeling. Maiden has a new skipper. But, you know, Maiden is her boat now. I'm passing on to the next generation, and I'll dip in and dip out as we go around.
But you will be there. You will be the skipper in everybody's view of Maiden once again.
Well, I'm the founder and leader of this campaign, but I'm quite happy to hand the reins to someone who's younger, and that's... This isn't about me, this is about Maiden, it's about her legacy, and it's about empowering women and giving girls the opportunity to expand their horizons and reach their full potential.
Tracy Edwards, MBE, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We heard from Tracy Edwards, MBE, all about the Maiden Factor. Now it's time to be a little more serious, as we welcome Penny Dodds from Dementia UK to the Grey Matter studio. Good morning, Penny. The first question must be, what exactly is dementia?
Dementia is quite a complicated illness, or it's mainly a set of symptoms around memory, language, how people function, judgments. Sometimes people describe feeling confused or disorientated or muddled. So it's a cognitive, neurological condition, so it affects the brain. But because the brain is very complicated. It affects so many different functions. I think it's easiest to think it'll affect everybody differently because we're all individual.
You say affect everybody. Is that it? Are we all going to suffer from dementia in a way?
No, not necessarily. There's a rough estimate that as we get older, we're more likely to develop dementia. So people over 85, they might talk about 1 in 3 people getting dementia. It's not automatic, but it's more common in old age. So the biggest risk factor is old age. And as we know, we've got a population that are living longer, they're healthier longer, and we've got many more people over 85 up to 105 plus.
Is it inevitable?
It's not inevitable. We know of many people who live very successfully into old age working. It's not automatic. Dementia is not an automatic, but it's something that I think we need to keep an eye out, and greater awareness of it will increase the likelihood that people can understand that something can be helped earlier, it can be recognised earlier. And at the moment, we think the earlier we can intervene and help and offer people advice and guidance, the earlier we can capture dementia, the more we can help.
And is there a difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yes, this has been quite a long-standing debate, really. Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. So dementia is the umbrella term, and then Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and that involves sort of gradual changes all over the brain. The second most common form of dementia is something called vascular dementia, which is a bit like strokes. So if you're at risk of having a stroke, you're at risk of getting a vascular dementia. So it's associated with your blood vessels. The third one is something called Lewy bodies disease, which may have a slightly sort of different clinical presentation. Sometimes people have more difficulties with visual disturbances, judging distances or judging how to step off a pavement, and they might have more visual hallucinations. And then the fourth one that is the most common is something called frontotemporal dementia, which can affect more behaviour. That can have quite a profound effect on families because they don't understand why a person's personality and behaviour has changed. Those are the four main types. There are many more rarer types. The main four would be those.
And is there a cure or treatment?
I think we're a way off cure. There are some drug treatments for Alzheimer's disease in particular, which slow down the progression. Those have been around for quite a while, and the drug trials are still on the go. The Alzheimer's Society do a lot of research into this. The drug treatments slow things down, they don't cure it. The other main thing that we're looking at is what can we do to prevent dementia? And that, at the moment, is one of the biggest public health campaigns, is how do we reduce the incidence of dementia by preventing people getting it.
And what can you do?
The main things we can do, and I would do myself, am doing myself, being middle-aged, is to think about diet, lifestyle. Unfortunately, it's a lot of the very common messages that we hear. Eat healthily, reduce your risk of stroke by reducing fat, alcohol, take exercise. There's something quite interesting about using how you continue to use and develop your brain. So learning languages, keeping mentally active, working and having hobbies past retirement. So really keeping yourself active and fit and well.
Presumably using modern devices like computers and tablets.
Yes, I think learning anything new is a very good habit to develop. And that can be a challenge for some of us, which I'll include myself in the middle-aged really? Generation of learning to use new devices. I've just got an iPhone. I'm having to learn, but that's good for my brain. So learning new things, using technology is very interesting. And I think we have to think about how we can use technology to help people who may be developing dementia.
You're involved in Admiral Nurses. So what's an Admiral Nurse?
They originate from the charity Dementia UK started up because a family who their father had dementia and he was known as Admiral Joe. So they started a charity to support. They wanted nurses who were specialised in dementia to work with families. So they developed the concept and started up the charity which supports Admiral Nurses, which is why they're called Admiral Nurses. And the model is that they work as a nurse specialist with dementia and they work with the entire family. So rather than just seeing the person with dementia or assessing the person with dementia, they'll work with the whole family and the whole system. We know that sometimes people with dementia are in very complicated situations. They might have physical health problems. They might need to access lots of different services. And having an Admiral Nurse who can try and oversee the whole system and maybe bring things together is quite a unique role, as sometimes care is quite fragmented.
How is it all funded?
Dementia UK is entirely funded by charitable donations. So it relies entirely on charitable donations from people. The money that's raised goes towards supporting the development of new Admiral Nursing posts. And at the moment, there's 226 around the country. The money that is raised also goes towards the 7-day-a-week helpline. We know that not every area has Admiral Nurses at the moment. but we have Admiral nurses on the telephone helpline 9 till 9 Monday to Friday and 9 till 5 on the weekends, and they also have an email helpline. So the money that's raised by fundraising activity goes directly to developing services and running the Admiral Nurse helpline and services that are supported.
The Brighton Marathon has contributed to that.
The Brighton Marathon, yes. So very recently, the Brighton Marathon, 50 people ran the Brighton Marathon. Some of them also did the 10K run. 29 people did the 10K. And that raised £45,000 for Dementia UK, which we're very grateful. And we've got 85 people running for Dementia UK in the London Marathon. So that'll raise some more, but we're entirely dependent on legacy donations in particular and people who want to do fundraising events.
How can people find out more?
If they haven't got an Admiral Nurse service in their area, then what they can do is they can ring the Admiral Nurse helpline on 0800 888 6678, or they can email the helpline on helpline@dementiauk, and Dementia UK has got a website, which is dementiauk.org.
And we'll repeat those details at the end of the programme, in case anybody didn't get a chance. Penny, it's obviously something very close to your heart, and you don't do it for fun, you do it because you believe in it. Is that important?
I think, having been a nurse now for 36-plus years, I went into nursing partly because I was quite young and it seemed to suit me. But as time's gone on, dementia has become more important and became a personal issue. My father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in about 2012. And unfortunately, his dementia was fairly rapid and he had other physical complications. And he died in Worthing Hospital in 2014. So dementia's a very personal issue to me. It's also a very personal issue to a lot of people that we know, and I would imagine that most people listening, whatever age, have some knowledge of a person with dementia in their family or their friends. It's not simply something that affects it affects the whole family, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. It's something that's for everybody.
As I mentioned in the introduction to this edition of At Home This Morning, there's currently a plan to restore an original Brighton tram to operational condition, as we can hear now from the president of the Tram 53 Society, Guy Hall, who first explains when trams first came to Brighton.
Well, they ran from 1901 to 1939, so obviously a long time ago. They started in November 1901 and finished on the 31st of August 1939.
What caused their demise?
As you know, if you look at a map of Brighton, Brighton expanded a lot during the 30s. So when you had places like Molescombe built and also Patcham, the cost of infrastructure putting tram track down and wiring was seen prohibitive, or prohibitive cost. So the trolley bus was the vehicle that replaced it. The trolley bus was seen as a more flexible electric transport alternative.
And when did they finish?
They finished in 1961.
Trolleybuses, I remember trolleybuses, right. And a lot of listeners will remember trolleybuses,
yes,
going up hills.
Very fast.
How did trams go uphill?
Trams are very powerful things. The trams used to cover all the old Brighton boundary. If you look at a pre-1929 map, the trams' furthest point was to Tivoli Crescent North along Dyke Road. They went up Beaconsfield Road, and of course they went up Ditchling Road and Elm Grove. So the trams actually had very good adhesion. They had very powerful motors, and apparently in the last summer of operation, they could still overtake a motor bus.
Where does Tram 53 fit into this? I mean, 53, presumably there were 53 of them.
Well, the numbering system, it doesn't make sense, but it was the last tram built. Now, the way they did it, they took a tram out, any one they considered worn, and gave it a new number. So that just happened to be the number of the one it replaced. But 53 was built about 1936-37 at Lewis Road, because Brighton built their own trams, and it only worked for about 2 years.
You've said Brighton built their own trams. I mean, is that the bus depot that's
in
Lewis Road?
The present-day Lewis Road bus depot, you look at the windows in the front, there's still one that says Brighton Corporation Tramways. Well, if you go behind that in the modern bus building, which I went to recently, a very interesting place, that's where they were built.
Who built them? I mean, was it just ordinary people?
Well, that's a good one. I mean, if you think back to, it's like running a railway, you obviously had a trained group of staff. Now, you had to have people who repaired the motors and looked after the bodywork, Bryant decided after some bad experiences early on to build their own stuff, keep it under one roof, in-house, if you like. So by the time 53 was built, they had a whole set of blacksmiths, very skilled woodworkers, as well as electricians. But record-wise, we've got very little of that.
So is this the only Brighton tram that exists? Because there are tramway museums in the country, aren't there?
Well, the fate of the Brighton trams was that because they finished just as the war started, most of them were burnt because they're very old-fashioned design and stripped of metal. 53's got nothing left of the original wiring. There is one other tram left, which is the old works car, number one, which we've been promised and will be moved from the house in Brighton.
What's the purpose of restoring this tram, or these trams, because both you've got the two of them?
Well, I'll tell you the story of how it happened. I'll be as quick as possible. I'm a keen modeler. I love making models of things. And I wanted to make a model of a Brighton tram. This was in 2009. And I remember seeing a picture of 53 on site at the time. Anyway, I found the picture and, quirk of fate, someone I work with, I work in different schools, said, I know somebody might know about this. The long shot was I got here, looked at the tram, thought it's in much better condition, and a little voice said to me, and this happens with men, this needs to be restored.
And having restored it, which you intend to do...
Well, we're getting there, as you can see. Well, we've spoke to Brighton Council, and we want to run it in Brighton. And Brighton Council are more interested in this and are going to come back with two or three sites. But we wanted to run it in Stanford Park originally. That's now not possible at the moment. But we want Brighton people to enjoy riding on something that's made in Brighton and owned by the people in Brighton, not a private company.
Presumably, it can't run on the roads anymore.
There's still track underneath, but I don't think that would be worthy. To run it on the road, I think, is a lot of health and safety, but a park of some sort, and that's what we've been talking about, would be great. And an open-top tram in a summer's day would be fantastic.
It would indeed. But coming back to the restoration of 53, what was it like when you first found it?
Well, to be honest, when I got here, I had very low expectations. I thought it would be a heap of wood with Brighton Corporation on. But when I saw the actual bodywork, it was in good enough condition. I thought, this needs saving. There's a tree grown in front of it. It'd been here so long. So when we got here, it was just a stripped-down shell, quite simply. But we've already had the top seats made. We're looking at the rewiring. We've got some of the electrics already. So it's a nightmare in a sense, but enthusiasm and blind faith get a lot of things done in this world.
How much work is involved? I mean, you're a modeler, but...
Yeah, this is a big model.
who are the other enthusiasts that are helping you?
Right, well, we've now got membership, I think, of about 60. Like most societies, we haven't got a huge active membership, dare I say. But what we've done, we've had enough skilled people who could do woodwork. We've been helped by a guy called Adrian Vaughan, who works at Tinker's Park, a professional cabinet maker, superb woodworker. And so a combination of amateur and someone who's very keen on the project, and he's been most gracious with our help. He's obviously got paid, and rightly so. So it's been a combination of just enough people had the skills to get things done.
Having got it done, where are you going to run it? I mean, we've talked about that already.
Well,
is it practical?
It's... What we're looking from the council, and I think the council understand, is if they just give us some land, it's a matter of track and wiring, but I think that would follow with sponsorship if we showed the project was a runner. But when we formed, very early on, we had this discussion, and we wanted it to run. We didn't want it lying in a museum stuffed. Brighton has had some unique electric transport, as we know, from Volks Railway. This is part of that heritage, and it's the last one left. It was the last open-top tram built for a standard system in this country. So she's pretty unique on a few levels.
And the general thought of running it, I mean, what powers it for a start?
It's got 250 horsepower motors. It runs on 550 volts DC, so you can't use Duracells on this one, which is standard stuff for the time. If you look at a tramway between the wars in England, these are very standard setup, you know. But it's going to need rails, needs overhead supply, etc. But I've already given the quote to the council about a 2-3 lane tram shed. The first thing is you need a shed to put it in.
And having got a shed and a home and everything else, who's going to run it?
Well, I think something different will have to happen. We're a group of enthusiasts who've managed to handle the restoration and are doing that at the moment. Then I think something new needs to be formed because then you're going to have some sort of operating company. Again, that would be a future plan. The first thing is to have something in motion, and then I guess it would come under the council umbrella, if you like. But you need some sort of place, obviously, with skilled people. You're going to need one or two people who know what they're doing, sort of thing, with volunteers in the background. So that's something I can't give a lot of details about at the moment. But I think if once this vehicle's got to a certain stage, people see it's going to happen, I think things will follow on. The other thing I'd like to point out is that it's been a proven thing that trams are a great attraction. Brighton could be a very unique thing. It would be the only operating tramway in the southeast. You're going to have to go to Devon, Seaton, to see a tram like it. And being 3'6", there's other trams of the country that maybe could come down as guests.
And of course, Seaton isn't full size.
It's a big model. No, Seaton does a fantastic job, and it's proved to be a great tourist attraction. But it's a 3/4 size, I believe. But 53 is a 3'6" gauge tram, same as Birmingham and a few other places. And it would be a very unique tourist attraction. I think the council realised.
How long is the timescale?
Well, there's two parts to this. There's the bodywork and the electrics. Now, the bodywork, I hope by the end of this year, we're going to have something that looks very much like a tram, even with the top deck on and the seats, etc. The truck, we can whisk away tomorrow, but that's the last thing we're raising money for. I think it's going to be about 40 grand. The truck will need to be widened. It's the wrong gauge. And, of course, it needs a thorough maintenance. But if everything works money-wise, then I'd say 3 years.
Not that long, no. in term.
That time will go quickly enough, as it does.
It will indeed. I mean, we've heard recently that the plans to move the Brighton Centre to the Black Rock. Is that a possibility? You're talking about 10,000 people.
Well, my dream scenario, which is probably very impractical, is the tram would run from Brighton Station and connect with Volks. But unfortunately, that involves road running. But that'd be a fantastic way to get to Brighton. I think the problem with running it on the seafront, one, we're in competition with Volks, which is pointless. They're going to have a lot of problems shifting people to Black Rock on a very limited roadscape, dare I say it. So I don't know about that, but a park is better simply for safety standards. We were offered a possible plan to run it from Hove on the seafront to Brighton, but once you start looking at mixing people on the pedestrian area with the tram, it gets very difficult.
Now, at the moment, it's located in... Can we say some
West Sussex.
Rustic sheds on a farm in West Sussex.
Yes.
where the work is going on around us.
Indeed.
When do you expect it to be on public view?
Well, when it's got a more permanent home. Once we've restored it, I hope by then it all coincides nicely, like the fairy stories, where the council and ourselves have come to an agreement and a positive plan. We do have open days here, twice a year, etc. But it's... I don't know. That's a difficult one to answer. Once it's finished, and I hope things are in place.
We've talked about a time scale.
Yeah.
And the other thing we must talk about is money, because yes. you've mentioned money already.
You need lots of it.
And is that a possibility? Have you got a source? I mean, we know that the Brighton Bell, we heard in a recent programme about the restoration of Brighton Bell costing £1 million a car.
Right, yeah. We're not in that league.
You're not in that league, but...
Well, what we've done with money, the first money raised was simply through subscription. Then we had donations. And what we do, like a lot of societies, we tour model railway club shows or any sort of show where we think we're of interest and people are, you know, will buy stuff. And we've raised, I think, probably about £45,000 all by ourselves. Last year, we had a £20,000 donation, which means the body gets finished. Overall cost of the project, let's say about £100,000. Well, we've raised about half of that plus already. But it's all been in-house. We've had no grants. We've applied for grants and we've been turned down lots of times simply because it hasn't got somewhere to be shown in public. But it's all been an in-house job. We're now looking at obviously expanding that and advertising space, things like that, as the tram gets more completed. But it's all been down to us so far.
And we've talked generally about where progress goes from here.
Yeah.
In your ideal world, what would you like to see the future of trams in Brighton?
Well, when we spoke to the council, I had a very lovely meeting with them, a very positive meeting late January, which was thanks to the Lord Lieutenant of Sussex, Peter Field. And there, I don't think trams ever come back as a mode of transport, but what I'd like to see is a heritage tramway in Brighton, which I think would be a unique spin-off. Also, if there's enough room to have a museum, maybe it'd be nice to have the Science Museum trolley bus, the Brighton one, down at some point for an exhibition. You know, we've got some of the archive stuff and we'd love to have a museum on site so people can understand fully about the tramways and the transport we've had in Brighton. But certainly my vision is quite limited to the fact that people can get on the tram in Brighton and enjoy a ride for 10 minutes and the tram's doing what it was built to do, which is carry people.
That annual general meeting that Guy mentioned is to be held at 7:30 in the evening at London Road Railway Station on Wednesday the 23rd of May. Their website is www.brightontram53.org tramproject.uk with the email address tram53project@yahoo.com, and on Facebook it's simply Brighton Tram 53 Society. And if you didn't catch any of those details, I'll repeat them all at the end of the programme. Now, as I think regular listeners will know by now, I'm a bit of a fan of musical theatre, and in particular I have a special soft spot for shows that include the work of George and Ira Gershwin. And so when I heard that their show Crazy for You was coming to the Theatre Royal in Brighton later this month, I got in touch. And joining us now are the stars of Crazy for You, Tom James and Claire Sweeney. Claire, welcome to At Home This Morning.
Hello, good morning.
And how's life with Crazy for You?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm in Sunderland at the moment. I'm very much looking forward to being in Brighton. I love Brighton.
Have you been at the Theatre Royal before?
Oh, God, I've been to Brighton loads. I love Brighton. I always have a desire to live in Brighton. And one of my closest friends has just moved down there. I love it.
So you're all right for somewhere to stay when you come down?
Yeah.
So what part do you play in Crazy for You?
So I play Irene Roth.
How do you find Gershwin and the music?
I love the Gershwin music. I think it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful, yeah.
You're from Liverpool. You grew up with the Beatles. So it's fairly different, isn't it?
It is very different, yeah. But it's wonderful music, you know. It's timeless music. It's fantastic.
How much singing do you get to do in the show?
I don't do a lot, actually. I've only got one big number, really, which is I wish I was doing more because it's such a wonderful song. But
how different do you find a musical like Crazy for You from the TV and stage work you do?
Well, it is stage work, isn't it? It's musical theatre. I absolutely love it, yeah. I love it. And that's been the majority of my work of late, really, theatre work.
I think the tour finishes in Brighton, doesn't it?
Leicester it finishes.
So what's next in store for you?
I've got a very exciting TV project, which I can't discuss at the moment. Lots of concerts, got my panto lined up, so I've got a busy year ahead.
I mean, you've got a young son. How do you fit that in?
He travels a lot with me, and we just work it out as we go. We're never apart too long.
Going back to Crazy for You, why do you think the older style music and musicals such as Crazy for You?
I think there's such an appetite for it, and what's been helpful with Crazy for You is Bublé, and when Robbie Williams did his swing album, it brought it back to a younger audience's type of music.
What part of Brighton is your favourite?
I love the Lanes, yes.
So you can be seen there shopping, can you, when you're down?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. Yeah, I love it.
Claire, thank you very much. I was talking there to Claire Sweeney from Crazy for You, and her co-star is Tom Chambers. Welcome, Tom.
Hi.
Crazy for You. I mean, it's quite a show. How does it compare to something like Strictly Come Dancing?
It's kind of like Strictly Come Dancing every show. We do an extra matinee, actually. So on a Wednesday and a Thursday, we do two in a row, which means it's kind of double the impact on both days. But it's all singing, all dancing, lots of tap dancing. And, of course, it's the Gershwin brothers who wrote it. So, I mean, it's the best sort of music to dance to, and our one special key ingredient is the fact we don't have an orchestra in the pit. We have the actors playing the music live on the stage at the same time as doing all the singing and the dancing. So much so we've had to make an announcement at the beginning of the show because people just couldn't believe it was possible to say that the music you're hearing is being played live on stage, because when they're dancing at the same time as playing, you can't believe when you've got a saxophone, trombone or a violin in your hand that you can actually make clean notes like they have. So it really is, it's the most unique production I think I've ever been involved in.
And you've been involved in quite a number of stage musicals, I mean Top Hat and things like that.
Yes, Top Hat, which was an amazing dream come true because I've always loved Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, and that was in 2011, and then of course with White Christmas, another lovely Irving Berlin musical. But yeah, Crazy for You, not many people actually know Crazy for You. It's not done very often, maybe because it's such a challenge, but it was actually written in the 90s, so even though it's set in the kind of golden Hollywood era, written in the 90s at the same time in the films like Harry Met Sally, so loads of one-liners and gags. It's so much funnier than people expect when they come and see it. they're expecting, you know, all the musical extravaganza, the singing and the dancing and the acting, but it's really, the script is so funny. There's mistaken identity. It's got a lot of kind of Peter Sellers, Dudley Moore sort of flavour about it, with all the comedy. It's really got every bit of ingredient, I should say, that you could sort of possibly wish for in the entertainment category.
I mean, it must be exhausting.
It is. I mean, there's a funny thing when you watch something at the theatre and you think, oh, I'd love to be involved in that. I mean, for the audience, it's just great entertainment. But then if you actually end up being one of the performers, you realise you have to be trained like an athlete. I mean, you have to keep yourself in peak condition. I go in ice baths every day to keep the ligaments and muscles repairing. Because it's supply and demand. It's funny, sometimes you think, gosh, I don't know how I've got the energy to do the next show. But when the lights come up and the audience are there, you just deliver. Somehow it just happens, and it's always like 110%. It is quite an amazing operation to be a part of.
You all look as if you're enjoying performing and enjoying doing the show. Are you really, or is that just good acting?
I think that it's the same with any production where your brain goes into the mode in which the situation is given to you. So you can have a day when you've woken up on the wrong side of the bed, or you've got things going on and you've got a bit of troubles, or even if you get a parking ticket or something and you're a bit miffed and all that sort of thing, that you, once you're in costume and you're on the side of the stage in the wings waiting to go on, there's a certain magic. I mean, cause it's an environment, it's a live environment. I mean, it's kind of soul food, really. And the audience are there, they're there to enjoy themselves. And it's an infectious sort of thing. It's a bit like musicians, they go into flow states. So when you start, your brain goes into a certain gear, a certain mode, a certain focus, and you do what is required in that moment. Therefore, if it's comedy or laughing or joy, then yes, your brain can be also thinking about the other stuff that's going on, but really you're just living in the moment when you're on stage.
Tom, I think the show ends soon after it's been in Brighton, doesn't it?
Yeah, we've been going since August last year, so we'll be on the final leg. We'll Brighton, followed by Leicester, and then that will be a whole year. So, about 326 performances in total, I believe.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm very, very fortunate that I loved doing Father Brown, which is the lovely detective series, G.K. Chesterton Stories. It's kind of in the afternoon on BBC, and they've very kindly said that they'd like me to go back at the moment just for one episode, because there's already a detective inspector. Mark Williams plays the Father Brown character, and it's just a joy because that's filmed in the Cotswolds. All you have to do is stick a camera in the middle of the Cotswolds, and you've got the multi-million pound backdrop of Mother Nature. And then after that, I'm afraid there are things in the pipeline, but they're not set in stone, and I will be auditioning along with everyone else for the next job.
Have you got a favourite number in Crazy for You?
I think that the audience particularly love I've Got Rhythm. I mean, there are so many songs in this that people suddenly think, oh, I know that one. Oh, I've heard that one. And you do coming out whistling the tunes, because there's I've Got Rhythm, Embraceable You, Someone to Watch Over Me, They Can't Take That Away From Me, Slap That Bass, Can't Be Bothered Now, Shall We Dance? There's so many great songs, yeah, but I think that I've Got Rhythm is one that the audience particularly enjoy, because that's probably one of the most famous.
Tom, we look forward to seeing you in Brighton, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I was talking there to Claire Sweeney from Crazy for You and her co-star, Tom Chambers. Now, there's just time to repeat some of those contact details. For Tram 53, their website is www.brightontram53.org.uk, and their email address is tram53project@yahoo.com. And they also have a Facebook address. For Dementia UK, you can contact them on their website, but their helpline email is helpline@dementia.uk, and that helpline on the phone, free phone number 0800 888 6678. And we were talking about the Maiden Factor. The Maiden Factor website is www.themaidenfactor.org. And of course, the Theatre Royal, if you want to buy tickets online, www.atgtickets.com. And just time to thank my colleagues, Richard Davis and Sarah Elgrew, for once again being here operating all the equipment. And in case you haven't heard of Sarah Elgrew before, Richard, tell us about Sarah.
Well, Sarah is a very enthusiastic new volunteer we have, and we're showing her the ropes, and she's picking it up very well. She's been doing some of the operations during this programme, and I think you'll agree it's worked very well.
And bringing a bit of glamour to the studio.
Definitely, yes. Much needed in our case.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much, Richard and Chris.
So are you enjoying it?
Yes, I am. I'm enjoying it thoroughly, and I've got some very good teachers in use.
And we'll be hearing more from you.
Yes, absolutely. I will be editing some of Chris's programmes and maybe even doing some interviews in the future.
Look forward to that. So until we meet again over the airwaves, this is Chris English signing off with the usual message, stay safe. And thank you for listening to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for all of our listeners, whatever your age.